the ticking time bomb of tension which could explode into a conflict.
We were walking right on the edge. We were walking right on the edge.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name's David Condon. Welcome to Inside Track, episode number 16. So, hello, Jay. How you doing, man?
I'm fine, thank you, Dave.
Excellent. Right, okay. Da-da-da. Getting familiar with that tune now. So, before we get into the show, if you'd like to contact us, you can make your way over to bookarmor.com and you can contact us via there. You can also see what we've covered on previous shows. There will be 15 shows there, 13 when I eventually get around to sorting out number 14. Jay, how's your week been, man?
There's been two parts to this week, I suppose.
Really?
That we could talk about before we start the show.
Okay.
The first one was, we did talk about this on a previous show, but I kind of repeated the dose. I went to the nearby Taoist temple to my place, and I consulted the gods again regarding the future of our radio show.
Okay. And what was the...
Well, what happened was, you go there, first of all, you have to sincerely... ask the gods for permission to pose a particular question. So I did that, and then you pick up these wooden blocks and you drop them on the ground. And on one side, they're smooth. On the other side, they're curved. And they have to land with, you know, one face down and one with face up. So that was okay. It said yes. Then I went over and picked the stick. They've got a drawer with maybe 100... little drawers, and you take your prophecy out of there. So I chose my stick. Then you check with the gods that you've got the right stick, and the god said yes. And then I went back, and I think it was number 21, and I took it out. And then I have this slip of paper with this all these Chinese characters on there. I have no idea what they mean. And at that point, the wife steps in and interprets them for me. And basically, it's a kind of condensed affair. But you can open up another book and it's got the original source for your message. And they're usually taken from kind of mytho-poetic sources. So ours was, it was about the weather and life as a journey. And it said that the clouds are opening, the sunlight is pouring through, and this is the right time to be doing what we're doing.
Right.
So apparently that is a very positive message there for our radio show. There is a small link with what we're going to talk about today, in the sense of I was making my attempt there to kind of find out what the future might hold. And some of the topics tonight kind of touch upon predicting the future. The second thing there is, I don't know if you've got any questions about the temple trip.
No. When you, so did you have to hand over a gift, you say?
I did take a pineapple with me.
Right, okay. Any particular reason why a pineapple?
Oh, pineapple. Well, you can bring any kind of gift of food.
Right.
And the idea is that you wash a plate. They have all these plastic plates with dragon designs on there. Wash a plate, put your offering on there, and then place this on the altar.
Right, okay.
And then retreat for a period. And supposedly the gods have to be given sufficient time to enjoy what you've placed there. So... honestly, I think we should slice these pineapples, but my wife just puts it on their hole. So you sit there and let them eat the pineapple. And the waffles were inside the plastic box again. I guess, you know, a god can work it out. But we just sit there for a little while, and then when it's all kind of ready, they've had enough eating time, then you can kind of take them away again. But you also burn some of this. They have these kinds of prayers printed on paper. All kinds of stuff printed on them, and you leave them and they burn them in these furnaces. And when they're burned, you know, that smoke goes off into the air as you're kind of offering to the gods as well. But we don't have to do that. There's the little woman there. She just takes the papers away and they do it later for you.
Right. Okay. So
it's all very efficient.
Okay. And so you're saying that this links into some of the topics that we're going to be covering this evening. How would you like to?
Yeah, I would imagine so, because some of the topics we'll touch upon are to do with big data and very much to do with predicting the future, not by going to a temple, but through data mining. So we'll touch on that later in the show.
Okay. So, is that your week in Taiwan, or
is there... Well, that is the highlight of my week in Taiwan. But then today there was a story that I've just picked up in the UK media, because there's been this leak of the Labour manifesto.
Oh, right, yes. Oh, leak, is that in inverted commas?
I think it's quite a good way to release a manifesto, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
If definitely. Someone did deliberately think about this, it's quite a good way to do it. The leak comes out, and then a week later you have the real thing. It's kind of doubles up. So one of the policies in the leak has a kind of direct bearing upon me and my wife, because at the moment, as I know you are very aware of this, but there is this Tory policy that was introduced when, shall I say the name?
Go on in.
Theresa May! Theresa May was Home Secretary before she became the leader of the Conservative Party. And then, I was going to say Prime Minister, but she prefers to say Supreme Leader of the United Kingdom.
Yeah, Supreme Leader suits her very well, actually. In the way she's acting.
She came up with this policy where if you're rich and you have a spouse who's a non-EU citizen, it's all right. You can come and settle in the UK. But if you're not rich like me, and many people just like me, I suppose, then you can't. Because you have to be able to meet this minimum income requirement of £18,600. And then your foreign partner can join you. It has been publicized, but again, it's one of these policies that, unless you're kind of directly affected by it or know someone who is, might not be so familiar with. Now, the number, actually, 18,600, I might be able to get a job, potentially, that would pay that amount of money. My wife did point that out. She said, well, you could go into London and find some job. It might pay enough. And I said, yeah, that is true. I said, but I'm not going to go back to England with some job that pays just enough money. And then if for whatever reason I lose that job or want to change that job and I can't find another job, I'm not going to have the Home Office decide that they can just send me a letter throwing the pair of us out of the country. I'm only going to take it seriously if there's security there. And there isn't security if you're just, you know, a boss's decision away, or a downturn in the economy away, or an illness away, from basically being asked to leave the country. So no, under those conditions, why should anyone go back there? They didn't make it savings dependent because I think they were wary. I think we know why this policy was invented, actually. It was invented because there are certain countries, certain regions of the world where the Conservative Party is not that happy about certain people marrying people from other non-EU countries and then bringing them to the UK. I don't want to name any names, but I think we know what's going on.
Can I ask though, Jay? Right, So what I didn't know about this particular law then was that if you then you get a job, you're on £18,600, but you were to lose your job, they can retract your offer of staying here, even for you, as even though you're a British national.
Well, I would be able to stay, but your partner would be forced to leave.
Wow.
So, if you're married, you know, you're married. It's not a game.
No. And so that would...
I don't even have a child involved. But if it's families, what are they supposed to do?
But isn't it correct, though, that all of that is void if you're, say, on benefits? And yet I remember someone telling me that.
I'm not so sure about the benefits side, but from what I do remember... if you actually go and look at it,
right?
I think it's basically. I think the other thing was, if you take your non-EU spouse there, they can't claim any benefits for something like 5 years as well, and they might not be able to access the National Health Service either.
Yeah.
So, all kinds of provisions, and they can't work either.
Wow.
So there's all kinds of things attached to it. You can actually go and look, and some people have said that asylum seekers actually have more rights than the non-EU spouse would have. I don't really want to get into a competition for rights with asylum seekers, and I don't want asylum seekers to sort of have their rights reduced. That doesn't make it fair. What would make it fair is for both groups to get a full set of rights, not to say, oh, that's not fair, I don't like asylum seekers now. Of course not.
No, I mean, there's that old saying that people would say that Britain was a good host but a bad mother, in the sense that the rights that you have basically seem to be ever decreasing if you're a British national. That's, in some people's eyes, that's how it's seen. But I know I know a couple that have recently gone through this experience, and they fell into that trap. But I didn't realise there were so many kind of conditions attached to it. Makes difficult. Difficult life, that is.
Yeah, as I said, I'm not about to enter into a deal with the state where policies can change and then they turn your life upside down.
So you're saying this affects you? So is Labour changing it then? Is Labour going to change this then?
Labour said they will do away with it.
What, completely?
Yes.
Wow. That's got to be an attractive.
As a point of principle, the principle being, why should wealthy people enjoy more rights than people who aren't so wealthy? What you just referred to there when you said the ever diminishing rights, academics have used this term disaggregation of rights. Right. So instead of every citizen having a full quota of rights, instead you start to see first, second, third kind of class of citizens emerging in the society. And it's also linked to things like Theresa May's been quite active with this. For example, stripping people's citizenship when they're out of the country so that they can't return to Britain, essentially rendering people stateless, which under UN, my understanding is that UN rules or UN declarations mean you're not allowed to render someone stateless.
You couldn't do that, yeah.
Yeah, the other one was there was a scheme they were developing where you could have a kind of superior visa for when you travel, so that rich people and rich foreigners entering the UK, you know, they get to go through the gold barrier at Heathrow Airport and don't have to stand behind the plebs for an hour. So again, it's this kind of, you know, creating these different tiers dependent upon basically your net worth. The world of the Tories is just filtering all of us, sorting all of us by what we're worth. And that is the basic, that's what determines our value, absolutely. Not as human beings, but just as, you know, bank balances and assets.
There's a guy called Aaron Russo who made Trading Places, director. He did a film called Freedom of Fascism. And in that, he was friends with David Rockefeller. And when you were mentioning some stuff there, it reminded me of something he said. In this film, he says that when David Rockefeller was asking him why he cares about, you know, the average Joe, so to speak, you know, he was told, you shouldn't really have to care. Don't worry, you're going to have the paperwork in place that when you get stopped by the police or whoever, they'll know to leave you alone. You know, you don't have to worry about those people. Why do you bother with those people? And that's that kind of attitude. It's breathtakingly ignorant, but we're seeing a lot
Burroughs,
of it.
William Burroughs, you know, the writer we mentioned last week, I read out his stuff about the mugwumps.
Oh, yeah.
He was born into a very wealthy and prestigious family his hometown of St. Louis, Missouri. And he used to characterize this in his writing. And he had this kind of sentiment to do with people who were not born into wealth. You know, he found like a kind of fraternal feeling with criminals and just people from the seamy side of life. And in his novel, he's got a moment that occurs a few times where one of these kind of rich people, like your David Rockefeller, says to him, "Why are you standing over there with the?" Well, I guess they'd be in the posh voice, actually, not the redneck.
Yeah, you could do a redneck voice.
Why are you standing over there with the apes? Come over and stand next to the white men. You know, it's this kind of thing. It's like, you know, basing the whole thing upon matters of birth and ethnicity and everyone's value being determined in that way. Yeah, if you're David Rockefeller, there's no need to care, is there? But for the rest of us, we're not waving papers, magic papers around that get us out of every bind or stop us even getting in a bind.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of David Rockefeller having a Nashville accent is quite entertaining, actually.
Sorry.
Boy, you look nice in them tight jeans, boy!
My name's David Rockefeller, boy!
Okay, there's a bit of stereotyping going on right there. Okay, so
dueling banjos.
But so, first story then, Jay. plans for internet surveillance in real time. Dun, dun, dun.
Not meaning to scare everyone. Don't come out from behind the sofa. Take that cushion away from your face. But it is another internet surveillance story that's slipped under the radar once again. And actually, when we say slipped under the radar, we're being generous there, aren't we?
Yeah.
Because actually, the government doesn't want to consult widely on this. So it's the government's actual. They're the ones sneaking around in the shadows with this measure. Fortunately, me and you were discussing this story this week. And we did say to one another, thank God, you know, thank goodness that there are people out there scrutinizing every paragraph of what this government does. Because truly, if there were not these people interested in the issues to dig out this stuff, you'd have not a single, you know, inkling. We dug out the PDF to double check. We looked at the government's bit of paperwork here. And myself and you, we had to literally kind of try plowing through this language until we, oh, you hit the jackpot and there it is.
Yeah, it was a line, wasn't it? For you. It was a sentence.
So you take over.
Well, so what they're doing is that they're building this net where not only can they, I mean, I always thought actually it would be pretty much real time with smartphones and GPS systems. I mean, all of that information is gathered in real time. So, I mean, what specific elements is it, Jay, that is this on sort of social media? Is this crossed all platforms, I assume?
It looks like it from the thing that it's actually basically seeing everything that you're doing on your device in real time.
Wow, so this is...
So, like you say, at the minute, yeah, clearly, things like this Skype call,
yeah,
it can be... It's probably being collected. We saw when Microsoft took over Skype that there was this period where they basically harmonized their approach with what the US intelligence services kind of wanted. One thing that you often see is there's some major technical outage, supposedly, when the platform gets knocked down. Everyone gets locked out and they say, oh, there's been some server crash. What they're actually doing is installing all this stuff, making sure it works and then flicking the switch back on. On that subject, Facebook had a massive outage in Asia the other week. There was a famous Gmail where most of Gmail got locked down. So I think often they're just like hooking up this stuff and then fire it up again.
Well, I know, I was going to say, back in 2009, it was a great weekend where Facebook, there were two things that were happening. Facebook on one hand was basically going to change your privacy settings. So unless you checked your privacy settings, your whole profile was going to be open to the world. And at the same time, the same weekend that this came in with Facebook, Google had also implemented a change where you could search anybody's name from Google search engines across multiple platforms of social media. So the same weekend that this happened, people were getting caught out because you could search the whole profile from just Google. You didn't even have to go to Facebook. And they kept these two separate bits of information completely in the dark, opposite corners. And suddenly they amalgamated into this big chaos mess this particular weekend. And people didn't know for several days. And people were having all their information taken off. And that, obviously, as soon as you realised, you would change your security settings. But it was just coincidental that Facebook and Google were seemingly working together. Well, that'll come up again, no doubt.
What seems to be the thing here, Dave, to return to what they're changing, or supposedly this
real
is
time,
a notable change in terms of their capabilities, and what it says, this is the duty that internet service providers will have to provide to the intelligence services upon request. So what it says is they'll have to provide and maintain the capability to ensure, where practicable, the transmission of communications and secondary data in near real time to a handover point as agreed with the person to whom the warrant is addressed. So that's one real time kind of surveillance thing going on. Then the other one is about working around encryption. So this is what would be called the backdoor part.
Yes.
So this is number 8 on this document. To provide and maintain the capability to disclose, where practicable, the content of communications or secondary data in an intelligible form, and to remove electronic protection applied by or on behalf of the telecommunications operator to the communications or data or to permit the person to whom the warrant is addressed to remove such electronic protection. So what it's all about is this encryption really does work, is the message that has been resounding since the Snowden revelations. It really does work. You know, they can't do much if the stuff is encrypted. So what's happening is they're taking it on. So one thing that we saw is they attacked the device. So one way to get around the encryption is to actually compromise the device. So that's been going on. And then the other one is to basically force a backdoor to be put in to remove the encryption.
Well, the idea of a backdoor, I mean, in either... well, let's just take Microsoft. There's backdoors built into the code. When I was looking at internet security some years ago and was looking at MAC addresses and putting into a router that you could filter out certain MAC addresses or accept only certain ones so only my devices could connect to it, then I read that because Microsoft have remote desktoping, in order for someone at Microsoft, if you're having issues, to phone into your computer and basically sort it out if you've got issues, they clone your MAC address. And that's a backdoor right there. That's basically, so it's hard coded into the software, the operating system, so you can't get out of it. So you can be a security.
We have talked about, we did talk about this before, which is sometimes there are these stories about where a particular piece of technology, the NSA gets their hand on it perhaps, and they physically alter its characteristics, and then they kind of package it up at FedEx and then forward it on again. So some of these hacking operations they do are done in this way. But then, as you've just pointed out, a lot of devices that you buy are basically hacked right out of the box.
Yeah, completely.
Because the standards technology that's been applied to them has already been compromised. It's become an industry standard.
Didn't we play a clip several weeks ago of Ed Snowden, who basically turned around in an interview and said, like, you know, the likes of the CIA want to own your phone. I mean, that's rubbing it in your face right there, isn't it? That's
I think with this surveillance story here, with this real time surveillance, we just mention it on the show now. We have to wait for it to blow up further, hopefully, and become more of an issue. Of course, it's happening right around the time of the election. So there's always this kind of useful way to use major events and then just slide this stuff in alongside. That is just the modus operandi from these.
I mean, wasn't
guys.
It?
So it's happening at the worst possible time, of course, because they want everyone focused on June the 8th, not on new capabilities for the intelligence service.
Didn't you say the other day that, you know, when they do big kind of announcements like this, it's because they've pretty much built the legal framework? They've been doing it for ages, but now they finally got the legal framework in place, the regulation, to make it legal. Basically.
Well, this one's slightly different, but yeah, my point there was this would be my it's not a criticism of Edward Snowden and his revelations, his disclosures. The problem is that there's two kinds of reaction. Now, one is it morally right? Is it morally right to be doing this? Then there's another kind of consideration, which is it strategically. So on the moral front, Edward Snowden kind of does object because privacy, he believes, is actually important. Some commentators and some government kinds of spokesmen and some spies basically tell us that our conception of privacy needs to be discarded because it's a kind of relic or an artifact.
Yeah, very 20th century.
We live in a kind of post-privacy world now where you've got no right to expect kind of privacy. So that would be their angle. But Snowden still says, no, it's important. Then there's the kind of the strategic part. He says, is it good policy? Is it good for the US to be inserting all these backdoors, for example, into technology when, of course, these backdoors are available to other governments and, organized criminals as well. So he's got that kind of sense of it strategically, but he's a patriot. His country is the US. You know, I don't actually care if it backfires strategically for the US. You know, I'm not a US citizen. I don't care on that score. And then I think the group that I find the most annoying, really, in this debate are the people who are the legal people. these are the people that basically say it's not right what you're doing because it's not legal, not because it's not right, but because you're doing it without laws in place. And I suppose these people might actually say that they've had a victory in the last five years or so since Snowden. But to me, it's not a victory. And the point we were discussing was basically everything that was disclosed by Snowden that these intelligence services were up to in the UK, all that's happened is it's all been legalized. It's all been put through in Acts of Parliament just to give it the okay. So is that progress that all this stuff is just made legal? Not really, not to me. And we had the chap in the Intelligence and Security Committee hearing, the guy who's got, in inverted commas, oversight of GCHQ. Yeah, it's one man with a staff of about three overseeing 10,000 employees at GCHQ. And they said to him, how do you make sure they're not doing anything, you know, untoward at GCHQ? He said, well, I sit down with them, he said. Well, sitting down obviously is the clincher for two English gentlemen in a room. So he said, I sit down, I have a chat, and I ask them if there's anything going on. And they'll assure me, no, there isn't. And the man, the guy in the intelligence committee said, what, is that it? And the guy looked at him like astonished. He's like, well, yeah, of course, that's it.
Yeah, what am I supposed to do in 10
so, games? No, just legalising all of it doesn't do anything for me. And I do believe, basically, that it's up to all of us to do what we can, even if it's just on a small scale in terms of adopting some forms of encryption on our devices. I'm not saying everyone's got to turn into some master hacker, but there are just simple things. I use the encrypted email service from Switzerland. The only problem, of course, is that, as we see here in this this update of their hacking, of the surveillance here, maybe I'm calling it the right thing. You know, the government wants a way into my encrypted communications, regardless. So maybe it's not.
You should understand, Jay, that the only people who do hacking are Russian or Chinese, allegedly, as we're led to believe.
Yeah, well, I'm forgetting myself, aren't I?
Yeah.
Of course, it's completely different when the UK government or the US government enters into your business. I mean, they can only possibly be doing it to stop the terrorists.
It's a humanitarian hack, Jay. Come on.
Keep you safe.
Hacking for humanity.
Well, on that same theme, we did mention, and there's been another development with it today. There's more investigation going on now of the Scotland Yard using Indian hackers to hack the accounts of environmental campaigners and activists in the UK. So these people are not terrorists, and they got hacked, and they didn't mind going overseas and getting some Indian people to do it, just to perform what they call an end run around any rules that there might be at home.
Yeah.
But as we will talk about with the perhaps if we touch upon the CPS today, it'll be a long time before we see any policemen actually being disciplined for this. And it's fantasy land to imagine anyone being punished beyond some kind of slap on the wrist here.
Well, when you're looking at Theresa May and the way that she's kind of carrying on her election campaign and the various reports that we covered some last week where people are just not getting access to her at all. And, you know, completely opposite to that would be Jeremy Corbyn going around shaking hands with real people as opposed to highly selected individuals. With the CPS, someone told me this morning that even to mention the CPS could result in being arrested. So I don't know how true that is, but
being arrested for what reason? There was this story today. There's a Tory message coming out that they were threatening to sue anyone.
That's it. Yeah, sorry.
These claims.
Right. So, but you. Right. Okay. So let's just get on with it. CPS, basically. CPS, because I'm thinking of computers. I nearly bought one yesterday, that's why.
Oh,
The CPS announces no charges in Conservative Party election spending investigation. Now, what was it, a couple of weeks ago we covered this?
We've referred to it repeatedly on this show. I'm not Mystic Meg, but on this occasion, my prediction, looking into my crystal ball here, I was quite correct. I saw there, I saw the shadows kind of parted inside my crystal ball, and I saw Tory MPs walking free, dancing a jig, popping champagne corks.
Yeah, going to their general.
Cynicism was vindicated once again, let's just say that.
Yeah, this is... And now they're threatening to sue people who even bring this up.
Well, one thing there that's interesting is they've already paid the fine from the Electoral Commission for these irregularities. So I don't really see that they have a leg to stand on. It's just simply a threat. The second part there I'd like to make is there was also Carl McCartney, who was one of the guys who was investigated. He's come out saying all of the Electoral Commission need to resign. Now, one thing he misses out there is the police. He misses out the police there. The Electoral Commission investigation was one thing. It found the Tories guilty of basically not declaring their spending properly at the last general election campaign. The second part, the Electoral Commission then passed on their findings, their evidence, to the police. Mm. And various police forces and the CPS received files from 14 police forces in the end. Various police forces spent months, some would say too long, investigating these this spending. Then they pass files of evidence to the CPS, who can then decide whether to prosecute. Well, Carl McCartney is a big man, isn't he? Because he's accusing the Electoral Commission there and saying they should all resign. No, he's not going to stick his neck out and say the police should resign. You know, is he suggesting that the police spent months on just spurious allegations? There was enough evidence from the Electoral Commission given to the police to have already fined the Conservatives £70,000. Now, that fine never made the headline news. It should have. I'm still sure many people are unaware of this fine.
Well,
so no, Carl McCartney there. But this other threat to sue people, what it reminds me of is the recent Marine A. Alex Blackman being released. Now, whether you think he's been the victim of a miscarriage of justice or not, now personally I don't believe he was a victim of a miscarriage of justice, and I don't go along with this kind of patriotic defense that it's only what a Taliban would have done to him. Otherwise there'd be no reason to go and fight the Taliban. If we're going to fight them on their own terms, there's no reason to go over there, is there? We're not fighting for anything better if we're no better than them. So I don't go along with it on that score. He did himself, right after he shot the guy, turn to the people there on his helmet cam and say, "Oh, guy, oops, chaps, you know, this goes no further. I've just broken the Geneva Conventions there." So he knows very well what he was doing and that it was the wrong thing to do. The point being, he's now being released from prison. Now, if you read the Daily Mail, you'd think that he's been declared innocent and given a pardon by Her Majesty the Queen or something. But the actual fact is, his conviction has not been quashed. He's still a convicted murderer. You can write that in the newspaper and Alex Blackman can't sue you. That's a fact. But my point here is, and my comparison with the Tories, is that right after he was released, I think Frederick Forsyth, the spy novelist, I think you're probably familiar with him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he came out saying, right, now Blackman's been released. We've got to see the second part of this story, the second act of this drama. That is basically throwing all the people responsible for him going to prison and spending a day in prison, throwing all them in jail. You know, and again, we're seeing this today. You know, not really any respect from these kind of right-wing figures for the institutions of our society. What Carl McCartney should have said, and what the guy saying, "We'll sue you if you talk about it," should have said, is actually, "Oh, we welcome the investigation. And we welcome the decision not to prosecute anyone. And we're very glad that this investigation vindicates us and clears our names." That is what you should say. Not these threats that immediately are following this decision. You know, it's played out like a zero-sum game. That is not how the thing should work, is it? So found that kind of depressing listening to this nonsense today. The Tories have been very lucky to get away with this, and to then turn around so ungratefully and start trying to get people fired and into trouble just seems like just hugely uncharitable.
Well, that's how you permanently change the narrative. You know, I saw an interview with that Marina, you know, Blackwell. Was it Blackwell?
Blackman,
right. He was on Sky. And, yeah, it's what's a little bit sickening, and someone pointed this out to me earlier on, it's the way that they're trying to push him as a bit of a hero in certain ways, when actually he's a murderer.
Absolutely. His case bears a lot of similarities to that of paratrooper Lee Clegg. I'm old enough to remember that. I don't know if you remember it, Dave.
I do not, no. Please explain.
This was a member, I think there was two para.
When was this, Jay?
This was in the either the late 80s or the early 90s.
Right, okay.
So I think he was a member of this group of the paras called something like Two Para, and they were out there in Northern Ireland. And basically what happened was one thing that was very popular in the Republic of Ireland, I don't know if it's so popular now, but with teenagers, joyriding really was one of the main leisure pursuits for a lot of Irish youth. So what happened was some joyriders in a stolen car drove through a military checkpoint, and they'd already kind of blasted through the checkpoint and hadn't stopped. They'd just gone on their way. But these paratroopers decided that they would fire after the car. And so they fired from behind the vehicle. So they're not in any physical danger themselves at this point, but they were just obviously, you know, what would we say? Excited by what had happened. And they pumped a load of bullets into the car, and they killed the driver. And I believe they killed the passenger too. Realizing that because the car was driving away, they were now in a spot of bother. They took a leaf out of Escape to Victory, which we did mention on last week's show. Mm-hmm. No, they didn't organize a football match between the Nazis and the prisoners of war, but they copied the idea which they used in Escape to Victory. They broke Lee Clegg's arm so that they could say that the car had hit him, and that this then became the justification for firing at the vehicle.
Yes,
this ruse didn't work, and an investigation was done, and basically Lee Clegg went to jail. And every step of the way, the Frederick Forsythes of the world and these kinds of people were bellowing away at anyone who would listen about the grave injustice that had been done to Lee Clegg. And I think he served a few years inside, and when he came out, just like Blackman, to these people in the military fraternity who see themselves actually as the only true patriots. The rest of us are just dross. He came out to a hero's welcome too. They have a very strange estimation of what constitutes a hero. In Alex Blackman's case, he shot dead a mortally wounded man. I think I could do that too, actually. In terms of what amount of physical courage it would require, basically zero. And Lee Clegg had his arm broken by his friends and also let off a bunch of rounds at a car that was running away from him. Again, it's not really like taking on a bear single-handed, is it?
No, certainly not.
No, so to kind of treat them as heroes, I think, is very strange. But in some people's imaginations, that's what they are, as you said, kind of disquieting. I believe they're now trying to secure the movie rights to make a film about Blackman.
Yeah, he said he hasn't spoken.
I don't know
about
what
it.
Kind of person's going to go and watch it. I just pity the person who's waiting for that one.
Well, they do this all the time, don't they? Do die, especially with 9/11 stuff. You know that they do the Hollywood version, and then that becomes basically urban legend. So.
And well, I might go and watch that film, but I won't watch the bit where he's in Afghanistan, and I won't watch the bit where he's released. I'll just watch on a loop the bit where he's in Wandsworth Prison. I'll just watch that on a loop.
Yeah, he said.
On a 9-year loop.
He said it was a very difficult time. I thought, well, at least you're alive to have a difficult time, mate.
Yeah, if I'd known he was having such a difficult time, I would have sent him some of those commando comics to tide him over until he got out.
You could have sent him one of those bomb... Do you remember that story some time ago? The bomb detecting... Oh, it was a toy, wasn't it?
Oh, the Iraqi bomb detector. That was a brilliant story, wasn't it? Those fake bomb detectors.
Yeah, yeah. It's empty. When someone opened it up, you just had a telescopic...
They're still using them in Pakistan, and like hotels and at checkpoints and things like this. The guy was a complete ruse, wasn't it? It was a complete scam. I thought that was... You know, there's a certain kind of demented genius that goes into that. You know, it's just like nothing at all. Just like a kid's toy, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Brilliant idea.
It's a plastic empty gun.
No one's going to come back and complain if they get blown up. There's no one to complain, is there? It's genius.
Yeah, it was completely empty. Just a plastic handle and a telescopic
handle. The only thing I can think of in his defense would be that there was another chap out there somewhere in the world that was selling loads of fake bombs to the terrorists too. So you probably had the situation with, you know, the fake bomb detector, not
fake bombs, fake the fake bombs. Detectors, the fake news about the fake bombs. What's not? We're living in a cartoon, by the sounds of it.
There was a similar story actually in World War II where supposedly the Germans built this entire village made of wood, which was supposed to bamboozle the Allied forces. Have you heard of this story?
No, go on, explain.
Supposedly the Germans built this whole village made of wood, which was supposed to attract or fool the British into wasting resources on it in some particular way.
Right.
And there is a might be an apocryphal story, but supposedly the British flew over it on a mission and dropped a wooden bomb on it.
That would be quite amusing if that happened.
Yeah, so I thought that one was quite amusing. But yeah, that guy is doing time. The only thing that is real about that guy that sold those fake bomb detectors, the only thing real is his jail sentence. That was a real 10-year jail sentence.
Which is done in half, isn't it? Under half. Was it 6 years? So, moving on from one person who seems to have got away with something, and we mentioned that the Conservatives getting away with something. The person I'm thinking of is obviously Hillary Clinton, but Comey, who was the one who allowed it to get away with having a server at home with emails that basically, you know, highly sensitive national security documents basically made their way out, including to Aberdeen's husband, Weiner. Is it?
Weiner. Yeah, the Anthony Weiner guy.
Yeah, Anthony Weiner.
Really awful guy. Yeah. The guy who sends the message of, like, the picture of himself, like the sexting picture with his little baby son behind him on the bed.
Yeah.
He's like the American version of Simon Dankzuk, if you can imagine.
That's a great comparison.
Supposedly, he had a sexual encounter on the bed of his ex-girlfriend, during the night while his two young boys were sort of sleeping. You know, the whole thing just utterly sordid.
Yeah.
The Weiner guy is basically like Dantzuk, but he's in better shape if you look on the pictures. He's got a very funny face, but his body was like the Incredible Hulk.
So Comey, who's the FBI that was in charge of the investigation into Hillary Clinton, all these WikiLeaks, which was quite funny because she's now blaming these WikiLeaks and she's now blaming Comey. Now, I've got a clip to play you. So this will be Trump, very short clip, explaining why he sacked him.
Why did you fire Director Comey?
Because he wasn't doing a good job, very simply. He was not doing a good job.
Did it affect your meeting with the Russians today?
Excuse me?
Did it affect your meeting with the Russians today?
Will the new FBI director be in charge of the Russian investigation?
Thank you. Right, so there's a couple of things here that I need to mention. First thing is, now you haven't seen this video that I took this audio from, Jay, have you? What's quite interesting about it is the camera is closed in very close to Trump's face, so you're looking straight at Trump, and the question is coming from behind the camera. Towards the end, the camera then pans back, and you'll never guess who he's sitting next to. Hazard a guess.
Can I have three guesses?
You can.
Hillary Clinton would be my first guess. I just throw that one out there as a wasted guess.
But that is good. That is good.
There's the second one. Guess it wrong. Male or female?
Right, hang on. Well, I'll just have to do the... That's the first one you got wrong, James. Next one.
Well, I asked for a clue there. Male or female?
Male.
me see.
It's been around.
Keanu Reeves.
Is that your second? You don't want to phone a friend?
That's my second guess. All right. Give me a kind of age range now.
Okay.
Are they old or are they young?
Dead.
you would imagine. In fact, you'd be asking how is the guy still alive?
Henry Kissinger.
Yeah. Hey! Well done, Jay.
First thing I've ever won.
Yeah, Henry Kissinger is sitting right next to him in the press conference. Just sitting there in their little thrones, you know, like they do, right? Their big high back chairs. And he's explaining this, and Kissinger is just sitting next to him. Wow, there's a guy with history.
Well, I did hear a quip about Henry Kissinger, which has stuck with me, which was, Henry Kissinger has so much blood on his hands, he has to wear flesh-coloured gloves.
Yeah. Well, the guy's been a major mover for like decades. He was in what was the president? I can't. El Blanco.
Ford, was it?
No. I can't even.
Nixon.
That's. I just went El Blanco then. Yeah. So
you have to kind of conclude that from looking at Henry Kissinger, you have to conclude that basically he's afraid to die.
Well,
not because he's afraid of the pain of death, but he's just afraid that there might be a judge there in the afterlife.
He's a big
pair of handcuffs.
96, isn't he now? Something like that.
196, yeah.
He was around at the turn of the last century. So we've got Comey being kicked out, and there's different ways of this is being taken by the liberal left. They seem to... I'll play this, Jay.
When I heard about it, I found it hard to believe that Comey, who I thought had some degree of integrity, would do this. What Comey did, I disrespectfully disagree with.
I should just actually, you know, preface this. This is a load of people when Comey allowed Hillary Clinton to walk away from the investigation of her email server and so on. These same people were telling the world that just how great Comey was, just a wonderful guy, and he'd made the right decision. Then they wanted him to be sacked, and now that he's been sacked, that they're now saying that it was completely out of order. And the reason why Trump has basically sacked him is because allegedly of the Russian investigation. We've just had Maxine Waters come out and say, actually, there is no evidence to point Trump towards Russia at all in any shape or form. We've had a few other congressmen and women come out and say exactly the same thing, that they've not seen any evidence. But now we've got these people who are now saying just how bad and Trump is and how great Comey was. And in the last several months, they've flipped and flopped several times anyway.
When I heard about it, I found it hard to believe that Comey, who I thought had some degree of integrity, would do this. What Comey did, I disrespectfully disagree with my opponent. What he did was appalling, and prosecutors from one end of America to another know it.
I think he made a mistake on this, and he clearly has a double standard when it comes to Donald Trump. And these jobs, if you're not in it for a while, you can't take the heat. And I think he just couldn't take the heat from the Republicans.
I am so disappointed in Comey. He has let the country down for partisan purposes, and that's why I called him the new J. Edgar Hoover, because I believe that.
Do you believe that Jim Comey should resign, Senator Reid?
Of course, yes.
I'm not challenging Mr. Comey's motivation, but I do think it was unwarranted. It was a mistake, and I think that Republican and Democratic former Justice Department officials have come out and questioned the move that he made.
Okay, I can't even hold it any longer. Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi have got to be the two worst examples to put up there and talk about consistency on the issue of Jim Comey. Let's just be very clear and let's all remember correctly that until yesterday, about 5-something in the afternoon, nobody had anything particularly good, warm, or fuzzy to say about Jim Comey.
It's not just Schumer. It's Pelosi. It's Harry Reid. It's Adam Schiff. It's Elijah Cummings, Steve Cohen, Patrick Leahy, Senator Tim Kaine, Dianne Feinstein.
Finally, Donald Trump's taking their advice.
Of people who are calling for Jim Comey to be fired or to step down. Now he gets fired and they're saying, hey, what's all this stuff with Trump?
So there we go, right? They've flip-flopped so much that how anyone can believe what these people are saying now that he's been sacked or fired, as the case may be.
Yeah. I've got a headline here on this LifeSet story, which basically puts it in a sentence. Democrats wanted Comey fired until Tuesday. So I watched Jake Tapper's show for my sins this morning, and they didn't have senators, they didn't have Congress people on there. They just had these kind of liberal pundits. And they were it was just so shallow, as you said, because for months they'd been calling for the head, for the resignation of Comey. And then today they were there. No. Now we want special prosecutor. Yes, we need a special prosecutor. And they're all nodding their heads together. It's just the worst kind of hypocrisy. But a great example of how confusing the Democrats' narrative has become. Do you know this Stephen Colbert?
Oh, God. Are you talking about his rant he did the other week?
No, I'm not talking about his rant, but I'm talking about something that supposedly happened at the recording of his latest show, recording.
Well, I'm going in next.
At the live recording of his show, as part of the show, they announced that Comey had been fired.
Ah.
And of course, he's got a liberal, you know, studio audience for his show. And this is the problem with the Democrats. They've moved around so much. Guess what happened?
They cheered?
The whole audience burst into spontaneous cheers. I have to edit those out. You see, so again, you know, what did they do? Like, cut, send the warm-up guy on and say, sorry, we're doing that again, folks. You're all supposed to say, boo, you know? But no, they've just completely confused even their most kind of ardent followers. No one can keep up with it anymore. No matter what happens, everything apparently is evidence of collaboration with Russia. And actually, when you don't find anything, that is only the cue to keep digging. They've become the birthers. They've become the birther movement over there on the Democratic side. You know, why won't Obama release the long-form birth certificate? You know, and then finally, after 2 or 3 years, when Obama did release the long-form birth certificate, there was the, it's a copy. It's not real. Why won't he release the original long form? You know, this whole thing. They will never, ever give up on the idea that there's some Russian connection here to exploit. I think sometimes people use this phrase, don't they, where they say there's no there there. It's
yes,
just simply in your imagination. So deep inside it. I'm just every day hoping that it will pop and we can all go back to leading our normal lives. You see, even when Donald Trump sent off those Tomahawk missiles against the Syrians and the Russians as retaliation for this supposed chemical attack, for these people, you'd think, oh, problem for your pro-Russian narrative, right? No, it's no problem. Then they say, oh, yeah, you see, he did that so people would think that he didn't have, you know, everything becomes further evidence of these ties. Even if Donald Trump had Putin assassinated, it would only be to stop Putin speaking out about Donald Trump's collaboration with him, right? It would only be Donald Trump covering up the evidence of their collaboration.
Yeah.
It's nonsense.
It's, I mean, this is getting to the point. Well, we'll get to the French election in a bit, but we had...
I saw this clip today. Oh, sorry, Dave.
I was going to say we had the same rumour. Oh. Circulating around the French election, wouldn't it? The Russians have hacked.
Yeah, and we had the Swedish election, the German election.
Yeah.
When we come onto Facebook, we'll talk about this kind of government manipulation and kind of bot armies and things like this that are being deployed to warp our fabulously pure democratic processes and to install governments that are, you know, tyrannical like Donald Trump. Did you see this New York Times op-ed today, this open letter to the Deputy Attorney General?
I did. I talk about overly dramatic.
I had to have a box of tissues there to get through it. It was like the end of Gone with the Wind.
Without the comedy.
Yeah, without Clark Gable. Yeah. So for anyone who's not read this yet, we'll put the link up on bookarmor.com. But this is this incredibly melodramatic message, this plea being sent out by the New York Times, the kind of the paper of record in the US. And what they're basically saying is this Rosenstein guy, who's the deputy AG, they're saying, literally, they're saying this: you're the only man now who can save our democracy. It's all up to you. Be our hero. Save us. Please save the Republic. I don't think that paraphrase is inaccurate.
That sums it up about right, actually.
And it saves you reading 1,000 words.
Yeah, it does get a bit difficult towards the end when they're really laying it on thick.
How can American democracy, after how many years is it? 240 years, something like this, in 1776. How can American democracy literally devolve now its future upon one man? How is that possible? If that was possible, wouldn't we be worrying about the system itself, that suddenly Mr. Rosenstein has to rise up and be our champion? I just find that mystifying, that a newspaper that wishes to be taken seriously would engage in that kind of, would issue that kind of statement. Very strange.
Well, yeah, when you've, you know, they're saying that there's one guy that's now responsible for saving the Republic. And all the weight are now piling up on his shoulders. I wonder if we'll actually do an open response to that letter at all.
Well, they painted a bullseye on his head. If Donald Trump reads the New York Times, he knows exactly who to fire next.
Oh, without a doubt.
And actually, Donald Trump had this guy write the opinion. Donald Trump had this guy write the letter, the statement, outlining why Comey had to be fired. So it was this Rosenstein guy who had to write Comey's career death warrant.
Yeah, and I mean, what's interesting is people are making a really big deal out of the timing of it. Like I mentioned a moment ago, where there seems to be an investigation going on in the background to check out the investigation into the allegations of hacking by the Russians in the US election, also ties with Russia and Trump. And you've got people on CNN and MSNBC yesterday sitting, you know, heartily saying, well, this is no coincidence, this has got to do with timing, this is because what was he going to find in that investigation with Russia? Trump's basically protecting himself. This is a cover-up.
I think the deeper part to this is actually Trump's style is a different brand of politics, brand of decision making here. And for these creatures of the Congress and the Senate, they're used to basically both sides pretty much playing the game. And at the moment, if Trump is going to be this autocratic and basically not play this bipartisan game, they're always talking about the bipartisan gridlock, but they all like it just fine. Because they want every issue that comes up in the Senate or the Congress, they always want it to be 50-50 on a knife edge. Because they always want the lobbying money to be pouring in on both sides so they can all fill their pockets. At the end of the day, they have a lot more that unites them than divides them. And Trump, basically, it's pretty clear, is upsetting this system. And so if you're a Democratic senator or congressperson, I'd be intrigued to see if they're suffering like massive drops in donations and lobbying money pouring into their operation. Because to me, it seems like money is the only thing that could be stirring up so much madness and hysteria and paranoia. They're just really, really mad about money.
Breadheads, every single one of them. But
you sound like Neil from the Young Ones. Breadheads.
Well, if you've... When you've got this investigation going on in the background, it'd be interesting to see who they will now elect to be the next one, because it's a 10-year post, isn't it, when you're head of the FBI. So you get the chance to work with at least a couple of presidents.
Whoever Trump nominates now, of course, will then have another firestorm, as they say, over his pick. So we'll then go back into the procedural side of how we can frustrate this guy being, you know, confirmed in the post, or how, if you can't thwart him that way, can we undermine his legitimacy and credibility from kind of day one? So again, I think we're going to, it will never end. It's never ever going
well,
to end.
Well, this is the thing.
I keep wishing it would, but it's like Coronation Street or EastEnders, isn't it? It's never going to end.
Well, it's the same thing happened with Jeff Sessions when they were trying to get him on Trump's team. And the Democrats basically threw a big spanner in the works. And the reason he got sacked was not because he had actually communicated with a Russian ambassador, because actually people on Hillary's team had also communicated with various ambassadors and dignitaries from various other countries. That is fairly normal from all accounts.
We didn't cover it, actually, but there was that Clinton Foundation link to a big mineral deal.
Yeah, with Russia.
Mineral rights in Russia, which involved donations to the Clinton Foundation, and then people linked to that becoming kind of shareholders in this operation or making money out of this these connections. Yeah, that never got played out, did it? But you can look online. It does. One thing that really does tickle me is when the Democrats are hopping mad that Donald Trump is using public office to enrich his businesses. When what on earth is the Clinton Foundation but the monetization of political power? It's just nothing else, is it? And after Hillary Clinton lost the election, immediately there was this huge fall off in donations to the Clinton Foundation. It really tells you all you need to know about its charitable endeavors, right?
Yeah, as soon as she lost power, she lost money, basically. Yeah. And they've wrapped it up now as well.
And actually, to go back to that, all this outrage and all these Russian connections, yeah, I think they're pretty sore about the fact that there's nothing they can do in return for all that UAE, Qatari, Saudi Arabian, tens of hundreds of millions of US dollars. They can't really do anything to pay those people back. There's no favors they can actually do for them. And so, yeah, that still is swilling around there in the background too. The fact that basically Clinton has let down all the people that thought she was a shoo-in for presidency. It's kind of the ultimate embarrassment for her. Although, as we saw last week, she has resurfaced and taken full responsibility for the fact that she lost, while in the same breath blaming Comey and blaming Julian Assange and blaming Russia.
No, what I thought was funny, it was Russian WikiLeaks, not just WikiLeaks. It was
she did say that, Russian WikiLeaks. I did find that really funny, Russian WikiLeaks. If it was 100 years ago, it would be Jewish WikiLeaks, wouldn't it? But now it's Russian WikiLeaks.
60 years ago, it would have been German WikiLeaks.
If the Chinese prosper and the Chinese economy grows quickly enough, it could be Chinese WikiLeaks within the next 10 years.
Yeah, the Irish potato famine, that would be the English WikiLeaks. But
the sun has set on that one.
Yeah, so we've got as a tenuous link between that subject and the next one. Those people who genuinely supported Hillary Clinton, I think it's fair to be said that they're generally, these are the people that are now running around rioting and so on. And like we mentioned Colbert, as in the Colbert Report, and there was also Bill Maher. Both of those have been up for really being overly explicit, rude and generally disrespectful to Trump. Colbert did a 5-minute spiel where foul-mouthed, generally quite rude, and insinuated links of oral sex between Trump and Putin. And then you had the Bill Maher on basically giving incest jokes between Trump and his daughter. So the way that these left people, these people on the left who supported you know, what I would class as the real regime, the language and the terminologies that they're coming out with is so rude and disrespectful.
It is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
I did find on the campaign trail, for instance, one, we've seen these kind of Trump and Putin memes with them kind of in bondage gear, engaging in some kind of homosexual relationship. Now, why they think it's not homophobia to kind of issue this kind of slur about them? I'm sure if there was some kind of thing going around about Hillary Clinton involved in some lesbian memes with Angela Merkel, one, I wouldn't want to look at them in 1,000 years, but I didn't really enjoy looking at the Trump-Putin ones either. But people would find that, you know, Hillary Clinton, it's the first one to cry sexism and misogyny.
Well, she has.
Most definitely.
Well, she has been mentioned.
Oh, sorry.
I was going to say, Hillary Clinton has been mentioned when it comes to sort of lesbian stuff. With Aberdeen, actually.
Well, but, yeah, but and then, like we say, the Colbert kind of homophobic rant.
Yeah.
Now, people on the left are basically saying that the right charging the left with homophobia over this is the worst kind of just cynical ploy. But actually, I believe that there is something a little deeper there. Why is it not okay? If Trump said those terrible things about grabbing women by the pussy and things like that, yeah, they were all outraged over that. But then Colbert can say, using, you know, Trump's mouth is just a place to put Putin's member. And supposedly, you know, that is all right for him to say. I've got no idea. It seems like because we hate Donald Trump, everything we say about him is okay. Whereas people hate Hillary Clinton. But when they said things about Hillary Clinton, it was not okay. And actually, when you insult Hillary Clinton, you insult all women. But when they insult Donald Trump, somehow they magically only insult Donald Trump.
Well, in that clip that I played...
It doesn't seem very consistent, does it, Dave?
Right, well, in that clip that I played a moment ago, which was from Fox, what they call the Fox News specialists, when the woman was talking about Hillary Clinton and the hypocritical kind of reaction from the left about Comey's sacking, she actually, I don't know whether it's a slip of the tongue, but she actually turned around and called Hillary Killery. Because of there is, you know, an alleged list making the rounds of all the people that have had various dealings with the Clinton family.
Well, again, it's like, yeah, you know, someone cleans their windows and then 30 years later dies of cancer. You know, they get added to the list.
Yeah, yeah.
It's another one of these bubble things where it's just a fringe pursuit. You know, actually, the deaths that I would tie Hillary to that I care about, I think you'll be able to guess. But for me, it's like tens of thousands of people in Libya or thousands of people in Honduras. One of the interesting things about Hillary Clinton is they're always presenting her as a progressive and someone who does a lot of good things for women and for like gay people. But actually, Hillary Clinton unleashed by supporting this coup in Honduras, she unleashed the violence from the right-wing government that took over there, that took out lots and lots of feminist activists and trans people and gay people have been murdered and persecuted in the wake of that coup that she supported.
Thrown off
Why
a building.
Did she support a coup? Because this Zelaya guy, I was living in Guatemala at the time, I was living next door to Honduras. Because Zelaya was basically, he was democratically elected, but oh, there was a problem with him. Guess what the problem was?
Guess what the problem was? He was not able to be controlled.
He was left-wing. So from the liberal left-wing, supposedly Hillary Clinton, is unable to tolerate a left-wing president of a Latin American country and conspires with right-wing oligarchs, basically, these super wealthy right-wing businessmen, to basically, they picked up Zelaya in his pajamas, stuck him on a plane to Costa Rica, and said, your time in office is finished. And then they took over. It wasn't a legitimate government. Then they changed the constitution. Then they unleashed all this violence there. Honduras quickly became, I think it held the record for a while, it was the most dangerous country in the world to be a journalist in, even outranking Afghanistan and Iraq. And that's still going on. There was an environmental activist there called Betty Caceres. You may have heard of her, but she was an environmental activist. And before she died, she fingered Hillary Clinton and said, if I'm assassinated, my assassination, you know, will leave blood on the hands of Hillary Clinton. So that's what Hillary Clinton did for Betty Caceres, got her killed. So all this stuff about all the magical, wonderful things that she does. Yeah, I'd ignore the Clinton body count that is all the stuff about, what is it, Vince, what's his face, you know, that guy that was linked to the Whitewater where the blood flowed uphill, all that stuff. Yeah, all that stuff is kind of nonsense. But the body count I'm interested in with Hillary Clinton are all the wars and coups that she sponsored.
Well, there's that great quote where she's turned around and said, in relation to Libya, we came, we saw, he died.
Yeah, and there was that awful picture of her going to meet like the G7 or a bunch of those leaders in France after the Libyan thing, after the death of Gaddafi. And there's a picture of her with her arms flung open, waiting to embrace all these world leaders. And she's just got that, we did it, you know, we hit bank. You know, she just looked like one of those criminals
off Ocean 11
when they do their amazing bank job and they're all smoking cigars on a yacht somewhere. It was just that kind of, you know, hit the jackpot face, and all the world leaders look like criminals as well, or thinking about their share of the loot. David Cameron among them, of course. Well, David Cameron, he's British, right? So he can't look too happy about all the money that he's going to make. He's there like, oh, it's terrible. Well, you know, it's money. All right, you know, like that. But he can't show his face. But the French guy, Hollande, the socialist, he's just got this look on his face. Like, you can almost see, like, you can literally see. I guess there wouldn't be pound signs.
Whenever someone mentions Hollande.
There would be euros. You can see euros in his eyes.
There's one thing I remember. Whenever someone says Hollande, I always think of Grange Hill and Roland.
Roland Browning, right?
Yeah, Roland. What are you doing today, well, Roland?
Well, that is the thing about Inside Track and our radio show, is that we do bring you the most kind of sophisticated take imaginable on international politics.
Grange Hill. Just say no.
The Grange Hill reference that keeps popping up for me, and it hasn't caught on, but for me, it is a natural connection that I've established, and that is that Owen Jones, the Guardian columnist and writer, and author, for me, Owen Jones, his whole demeanor is basically Gonch off Grange Hill. So if any of our listeners are old enough to remember Gonch and foolish enough to have encountered Owen Jones's writing, then
isn't
you
can
kind of
one?
Think about Gonch next time you read his stuff.
I've got a picture of him yet. It wasn't that the ginger haired one.
He always had some kind of wheeze, didn't he, that would put everything right, that invariably kind of went wrong.
Right, so the reason I brought up Hillary Clinton in that little bit on the left, you have some identity politics news.
Well, we do have one story this week. Right, okay. We don't have a transgender jingle yet, but maybe you should get one.
Yeah, well, I should get one.
I guess if it's an identity politics jingle, it would have to change every single week.
Yeah, well, I've got an idea for that. Okay,
we need one of those pieces of software that makes one of those evolving pieces of music, or one of those Steve Reich.
It's called a randomizer. That sounded like the Twilight Zone.
It did, didn't it? But that's what we're just about to enter here.
Yeah, it might as well be. It's like almost a different universe.
If the not. University appears to now be a different universe.
Yeah, well, this is the thing, and this is where it's predominant. That's it. It's the ginger-haired lad. Someone's just found... Jeppy's just found it for me on the computer.
Oh, dear.
So it is the guy. Oh, my God. Oh, I remembered. How long ago was that? Jesus.
Grown old, haven't we, in the meantime?
Wrong side of 45.
Guy's now. About 90 now.
85.
Ziggy's in a retirement home, and Zamo is 115.
Yes. Still saying no.
Can't say anything now. He's just there in a wheelchair.
Just saying nothing.
Yeah, just dribbling.
Saying nothing. Just say nothing.
Right, so where do you want to start with this identity politics story? There's some interesting takes on this.
Now, it does. The sort of centre of this story is a 15-page philosophy paper published on this by this feminist journal. Don't worry, we won't be posting a link to it. And I doubt whether many people. It's a little like one of these controversial movies, isn't it? Where the more controversial the movie, the less people that have actually seen it. Yeah. So if you think back, there was the what was the Mel Gibson movie about Christ?
Oh, Last Temptation of Christ, wasn't it?
Yeah, The Last Temptation of Christ. Well, before that movie had even come out and anyone had seen it, there were already people kind of chaining themselves to buildings or going on hunger strike because they were so annoyed. But actually, in the end, it was a different thing. But people will take sides before the things even come out. And there's just a lot of heat and little light, as they say. So the centerpiece of this is a 15-page essay or article in this feminist journal. And it takes as its departure point a kind of comparison of transgenderism, and trans activists have actually objected to this word, although there doesn't appear to be another word you can use, but basically people who are transgender, like a kind of abstract noun for them, transgenderism, compared with transracialism. And the transracialism case, there's only a single one at the moment, although there are supposedly other ones around the world. But the most famous one, we've had her on the show in terms of talking about her. She's not, sadly not been a guest yet, is the Rachel DeLazelle woman.
Yes.
Who, for anyone unfamiliar, I think Dave can kind of fill you in on her.
So this is an American woman who was part of a black activist group, I believe. Is that true, Jay?
She was actually, I believe, elected as the head of a chapter of the NAACP.
Okay.
National Association for the Advancement of Coloured Peoples, despite actually, as you're about to tell us, not actually being black at all.
No, well, this is the thing, and this is where you said the transracialism, where people can wake up one day and identify as a man or woman, completely, against what it was you were born as biologically. Well, seemingly you can now do the same thing with your race. And there's a great video of her parents online on YouTube. Basically kind of middle-class white Christians, you could say. Who basically turn around and suggest to their daughter that she should go and seek mental health assistance because she's been going around telling everyone she's black. And from all accounts, she gets treated as black, even though she's not black. It's a very interesting case,
because, actually. Well, it is interesting. What she does there is that if we go along with what the philosophy professor is basically kind of looking at is, this whole kind of constructionist argument, this kind of social constructionism. So this would be the idea that there's one thing which is kind of a biological foundation. And then on top of this, there's our culture. And so they want to draw like quite a distinction between the two and say that your biology might indicate one thing, but then there's this other part, this cultural dimension, which may mean that your identity doesn't sit well with the biological part. And people should be free, basically, to pursue how they want to be, how they want to live on the basis of, these feelings that they have or these thoughts that they have. So if you say I was born a man, but I don't really find all the gender kind of roles that are mapped out for males, I don't feel that's me, then you can basically choose to move over and assume another gender identity. And not only can you move over and assume it, but the institutions of the society in which you live, your employer, the university, the border agency, the hospitals, all these other institutions, they also have to acknowledge this change in your identity and they have to respect it. So if you go to the hospital, they must place you in a woman's ward if you have to have an overnight stay. If you're arrested by the police, they must place you in a woman's prison, or a cell with women. And if you want your passport changed to say Mrs. instead of Mr., then they must, they must respect that too. So this seems to have been a growing thing over recent years, that there's been more and more of this kind of focus on this transgender side. Where the philosophy professor has run into trouble is naturally, she might not have foreseen it, but when you compare it to transracialism, then transgender people are going to be very, very upset because most people regard the DeLazelle case as kind of spurious. And to equate them is very disrespectful to transgender people. So that's why she's run into this, I used the word twice today, it's the firestorm episode of Inside Track. But it's another firestorm here. Yeah, but this professor is prepared to entertain the idea. If you can move with your gender identity, can you move with your kind of racial identity? And she concludes that the arguments are basically kind of similar.
I find this fascinating. I mean, this whole idea of, I mean, self-awareness comes into this. How do you see yourself? I mean, we mentioned a French-Canadian psychotherapist that was looking at transgenderism from a kind of more psychiatric point of view. And his conclusions were that the one consistent thing that basically everyone who he's come across in a number of years' worth of study all have a form of, whether it be depression or something along those lines. And I'm not necessarily saying that this that Dolezal is basically, you know, mentally ill, but that's what her parents think, you know.
I think one interesting thing there, Dave, is that trans activists themselves, as we've pointed out, they often point to their high incidence of mental illness, but they blame this on society. They don't blame it on that it originates with them, potentially. You know, society is to blame for everything. If only society changes, then this mental illness will recede. Would be their argument. Now, the other point here, I did come up with one counterexample that hasn't been examined.
Right.
But what about, this would be a hypothetical here, what about if you didn't feel like you identify with your age?
Well, that has happened. Have you not seen that?
So you could have trans ageism have your passport changed to say that you're 15 when you're 51.
Are you 75
and get your pension? Yeah, sorted. Free TV license.
Oh, Jeffrey, straight on the free money. I was supposed to be 16 again. Jeffrey, straight on the free money.
Right. Right, there
is laser.
No, Jeffy, I'm 100 and I want it backdated.
This has come out. This has happened. There is a case. Maybe you should have a try, look at if you can Google this, Joe, while I'm explaining it. There is a guy who wants to be treated as a 6-year-old, right? A 6-year-old girl, specifically. And, I mean, this is crazy. You're going to think
I'm making this. It's not called Donald Trump, is it?
No. Honestly, right? There's a guy who has now moved in with a foster family. The foster family are now, this guy's in his 50s, right? He was married, had kids, but he wanted to identify, he self-identified as a 6-year-old girl. So he's now moved in with a foster family, and the foster family are looking after him, and he dresses up and acts like a 6-year-old girl.
But have the institutions of his society changed to reflect this?
No.
Have they issued him with a new birth certificate? Is he allowed, does he have to, have mandatory attendance at preschool? Does he have to wait another 12 years before he can drive an automobile? Or is it just happening in this, they're entertaining his fantasy like solely within his foster family?
Right, I'm just going to have a quick look for it now on the old
game. Oh no, please don't search for it now. So actually that's interesting if someone's brought that up, because again, it seems to me that you're giving far too much credence to whatever things people kind of think of or imagine. What about these? The mental hospitals are full of people who believe that they're God, so, or Jesus Christ. So should we allow all these people to change their passports to, you know, God, or become recognized as Jesus Christ?
Right. I just need to send you this, Jay, because you need to see this now. Right. Now, this is, I think his name's John, right? His name's John. And, yes, he's there with his foster family. And he's there dressed up as a 6-year-old girl. And
goodness.
Yeah, they all look really happy.
He doesn't look 6, though, does he?
No, he's 52, that's why, Jay. But he's trying his hardest. I mean,
he looks like Mrs. Slocum, for anyone not looking at the video here, which is everyone who's listening. He looks like Mrs. Slocum from Are You Being Served? Well, I'll use Mrs. Slocum as the picture for this week's show.
Yeah, okay. But yeah, that's actually, that question that you raised, there's the answer. Yes, you can. Now, I don't know how far into sort of like the legal infrastructure around an individual, whether you're allowed to be treated like this in law, and would he be able to choose to go to school, for instance?
there was a famous case about 7 or 8 years ago of a Scottish guy who was about 36 who had been attending school in Scotland and pretending to be 15 and passing himself off quite successfully as a student. And he, right. I think he attended for 6 months until he got rumbled.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think
he was inspired by the example of some of those Bay City Rollers, I think.
So with this,
but what
whole
we were
point,
talking, oh, yeah. Sorry, but what I wanted to talk about was the Delezal in terms of one thing I wanted to say was there's a difference. She grew up later with some very close relationships with black people and began to identify with the struggle of black people in America and with their culture and with their history. And perhaps, understandably, the white man and the white woman have not covered themselves in glory historically in the US in their treatment of native peoples and their treatment of African Americans. So she perhaps was experiencing a kind of intense form of what is sometimes called white shame.
Yeah.
So I understand that. I lived in the US and I lived in the South, and I did mention this on a previous show, but it still fits here, which was I worked in a bookstore, Barnes & Noble, in Memphis, and we had a lot of black workers there and a few white workers there. And I was the one white person where the black people felt the most comfortable, because my history as an English person did not intertwine so intimately with that of the white Americans working there. You know, I was just seen as, you know, someone who was just off to the side, neither one nor the other in terms of the baggage. So I can understand if she does feel that sympathy or that identification. But the point being, empathy, sympathy, it doesn't spill over really into being the thing that you identify or sympathize with. And we did use this example here when we talked about this. For example, works of art. If you really enjoy the music of a particular band or you enjoy a particular writer's work, you know, you can feel really close identification with what they do, but you never feel like you're mixed up with them in terms of your personal history or your physical being. It's just the work itself. It's the ideas. It's what's in it. In that sense, you feel the closeness, but it doesn't spill over that when I listen to my Joy Division records that thankfully my wife likes them. So I do listen to my Joy Division records. Not every partner would tolerate them, I suppose. But I don't become Ian Curtis when I'm listening to them. You know, I just have a very close identification with that particular music. Seems to me that is natural. The unnatural part is just that final part, that idea that you kind of pass over somehow magically into being this other thing. I had some other examples, which was Wayne Rooney doesn't turn into a football because he's always playing football all the time. Or Ronnie O'Sullivan, you know, he's brilliant at snooker, but he won't wake up one day and be like a triangle. You know, it doesn't work that way.
So what's the point of the end game then? What would that be, the end game? I mean, if we, let's just say, anyone can identify as anything they like, whether it be gender or indeed race, or as we've just seen, age, which is crazy. And let's say, for argument's sake, that all the infrastructure around an individual will also be allowed to be changed accordingly to whatever it is you identify with. Is this purely to, you know, allow people the comfort, the safe space where they can look forward to walking out of their home and never having a bad day or a crossword with anyone again, like a Star Trek utopia?
Or you step in here with one of your dastardly UN master plans for humanity where they're creating these kinds of drones who won't breed and kind of happily surgically altering themselves and taking themselves out of the reproductive race. And basically you'll end up with robots doing most of the stuff. Then you'll have this class of trans people or people that have had some kind of gender manipulation. They won't be. They'll just sort of die off. They'll just be happy with what the system gives them. And then you'll have the crazy savages who still want to produce children. Maybe it will be this kind of scenario. I'm not really sure why it gets pushed so hard. Seems to me when you're in places like Taiwan, the thing that makes me think it's being pushed incredibly hard is just how uninterested in how what a non-issue it is on most of the planet.
Yeah.
But in just a couple of societies, it seems to be way up there on the list. So it does make me curious as to just why. It could be not that important in one area of the world, but somehow seemingly almost the only issue that counts in another part of the world. One thing it does do is it draws people away from sort of class issues and just has them end up just this, it just intensifies this kind of war of the sexes by introducing these indeterminate kind of examples. As we've seen before when we discussed it, a lot of trans people despise like old school feminists as well, because they say just by not being a man anymore, that doesn't make you a woman. You might not be a man, but you're not a woman. You're just a not man. You know, it doesn't logically follow, basically. But trans people reject that. They say we're every bit as much a woman as a biological
woman. Was it Greer?
It was Jermaine Greer. Went into this. And so she suffered the wrath of these people.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the other interesting part, maybe before we move on, but was that this feminist journal where this article was published, you have to say, did you read the article I sent kind of mapping out this witch hunt against this philosophy professor?
Bits and pieces of it I came across.
Yeah. This organization demonstrated absolutely no fiber at all, no moral fiber in terms of defending this professor. They immediately capitulated. They announced an immediate review of their procedures for publishing articles. They said they should never have published the article. They even say that they're in mourning for all the people that they've offended on this thing. And some of the language is almost, well, it's comical, the language. Can I read you a little bit of some of this language?
All right, Conan.
Now what happened first was there was this open letter to the journal from a whole bunch of professors and activists, like demanding that this article be removed. And at the end of this open letter, they had to put a correction on the open letter. They've got this kind of addendum. And this is because when they demanded the article was removed, they didn't properly pay sufficient attention to the anti-blackness of the philosophy professor's paper. So what a terrible oversight, right? So they said here, we acknowledge that this statement should have named anti-blackness directly. The statement is not an exhaustive summary of the many harms caused by this article. We hope it will at least serve as a way to register that harm and issue a demand for a retraction. This is one step in the direction of seeking accountability for the harms committed by its publishing, and to begin a conversation about the larger problems with our discipline it represents. And we thank blah, blah, blah for pointing out the dangerous erasure of anti-blackness and the erasure of the black labor on which the rhetoric of our own letter is built. So there's this kind of strange language there, you know, this kind of overly sensitive, endlessly nuanced kind of language. And then in the apology from the journal, this would be the last bit before we move on, this would also give you an idea of their language. Let me see. You might want to hum a tune as I'm reading through this Facebook post. I'm spoiled for choice.
Well, it's just that what I'm thinking actually as you're reading that is that it's almost like these people are encouraged to play the victim at any chance that they have. Any chance to say, oh, I find that offensive. Oh, that hurt my feelings. And obviously with the idea of stifling debate, you're not even allowed to talk to these people. You can't go to their universities and do speeches because you're banned, because you're going to be offensive to somebody. Right? So it's going to be a real dark day if they get their way eventually in the ways that it seems that they want.
Oh, dear. I can't even be bothered to read it out, actually, because it's just literally, as you said, more of the same. The problem we've got here is, I will just sum it up, is what I would suggest is if we were prepared to honour one another's good intentions, if we were genuinely prepared to honour the good intentions of one another, then whichever words we chose to communicate with one another, we would understand that behind them lay good intentions. Whereas this does away with all that. You know, every single message is dissected and treated with the utmost suspicion if it comes from the other side. And whereas any of your allies in this particular struggle, you know, you might give them a pass instead of subjecting them to the same kind of analyses. Or internally, they then war with one another over the language, because if you do so, you might rise in the pecking order. So it basically devolves upon this issue of, could you just believe that the people you're communicating with or discussing things with mean you no harm? No, they can't, because they've locked themselves into this bubble where they believe that words themselves contain violence, basically. Words equate to violence. Whoa. So they can no longer really communicate. What they should actually be calling for is like the worldwide banning of all speech would be the logically consistent thing to demand now, instead of endless talking about the violence of talking.
There is, interestingly enough, I can't remember the name of the word. There's a word for the study of frequency and of words in particular, that certain words carry certain meanings, obviously, but frequency, so meanings within frequency. So the way in which you feel internally when you hear certain words has an effect on you. There's, I think it was a Japanese scientist that did studies on vials
of water.
I've
heard of this.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they measured something like this thing called galvanic skin response,
right,
something
okay.
like this, which basically means when you've got electrodes attached to you and we say the word, the electrodes record or measure something different
the
depending
reaction.
On the words.
Yeah.
And so when they said cancer to a person, you know, a Western person, so basically you have to understand what the meaning of the word is, I believe. It's not magically inside the word if
oh,
you don't
right.
understand what it means. But they would say something like cancer, and your skin would demonstrate this response, that word basically caused you anxiety.
Well, this is a bit... This study I was referring to is a little bit different in the sense that what this guy was doing was that he would be using vials of water, and one vial he would continually tell that he hated it, and then continually tell the other one that he loved it. And what he found over a period of time, that when he froze these, the one that he'd been basically telling that he hated had frozen in a really kind of ugly pattern, whereas the one he was telling that was he loved, had the way it had frozen, the ice crystals were perfectly formed and symmetrical. Mm. So it's a really interesting area. I've only just recently come across it myself. Is
actually, now you say that, yeah. I have encountered that one too.
Right.
And actually, when I was at the university, I was studying this global health master's program, and we had people drawn from different countries and cultures there. One man was one student, he was from India, and we all gave these presentations, and mine was on Honduras, actually. So I looked at this the kind of environmental situation in Honduras as part of mine, and some public health issues to do with defending the environment from sort of big business. But we all went around the room and we did presentations on different kind of, you know, mainstream stuff, and then the Indian guy stood up and did his, and the other students, some of them at least, and especially the professor, watched in open-mouthed horror as he presented what you've just described to a room full of clinical professionals. You know, it included a surgeon, a doctor, a psychiatric nurse. They're all strictly scientific people. And he showed this vial of water that had been played heavy metal music,
yeah, yeah,
and formed all these horrible crystals, and another one that had been played, I don't know, Beethoven or something, and had formed the appropriately beautiful kinds of crystals. And at the end, he was basically advised by the group during the feedback not to think of revisiting this kind of material. That's just seen as pseudoscience. But yeah, people can investigate it.
How can it be pseudoscience when you get a result different from an experiment?
Yeah, the pseudoscience part there would be that perhaps the different vibrations in a heavy metal tune compared to a Beethoven symphony, perhaps they actually do produce different crystals in the water because of the different vibrations. And perhaps subjectively, or, you know, you find one pattern more harmonious or more beautiful than the other one. But to then sort of try and suggest this, the professor who was doing this was kind of suggesting that there was something therefore kind of malicious or evil or harmful inside the culture that produced the heavy metal music, whereas the other one was this kind of frequency of love and peace. The problem is what you're trying to extrapolate as a conclusion. Sure, they produce different effects on the water, on these crystals, but it's what you try to say that those effects then mean is the pseudoscience part.
Well, if human beings are 90% water, then whatever they would affect water, that would also be the same as the human body. So,
well, if it led to a worldwide ban on heavy metal, Dave, I'd be all for it.
You'd be right with that. I'd probably be a bit disappointed myself. But it's the difference as well, isn't it? The tuning system we have, which is 440 hertz, which I believe is a German tuning system. I think it was 332 was the one we used before 440. Was it? Or 333?
324.
It's early 330s, somewhere around there. And when people have studied those two frequencies, so concert pitch, all music nowadays is in the 440 tuning hertz range. Whereas older music tended to be in this, it was easier to listen to, some would suggest. So it's an area of study, again, I've only just recently
come across. It is fascinating, but the unfortunate thing about this topic is that usually when you encounter someone in real life that's very knowledgeable about that kind of matter, they're the same kind of people that, you know, in the corner of the pub start taking out maps of the pyramids and things like this, you know. So.
Some people might like
to while away their time learning how, you know, the pyramids form part of a great system and they're connected with Machu Picchu and Tikal.
Ley lines. Ley lines.
There's only so much drinking time in a day, David.
It's
ley lines.
Well, we did used to live in Totnes, which was the kind of hippie central out of the crowd.
I remember once someone...
And I did have a joke about ley lines, if you want to hear it.
Right, hang on, just before you say that, I did have someone once sit on my glasses when I was in Totnes. And when I was a bit, you know, obviously disgruntled at the fact my glasses were now bent up, the person who sat on my glasses turned around and said, it was the ley lines. Exactly, you made him sit down on my glasses.
Do you want to hear my ley lines joke?
Go on then.
Totnes is the only town in the UK where you can get a traffic ticket for parking on double yellow ley lines.
Yeah, hang on, we've got one there somewhere for that.
They'd leave like a magic spell on your car, wouldn't they? They put an amulet.
Well, especially
it will cost you 60 a fixed penalty curse. It will cost you, you know, you'll have to sacrifice a frog at midnight under a full moon,
right?
Or something to lift this curse and pay £50 to Torbay magistrates.
So we've got next on the agenda the Russian elections. I mean, we could just gloss over that by saying
Russian
this.
Russian elections.
The Russian election. French election.
I thought the French.
What am I saying? You know why I'm saying Russian? That's because I'm lining up that. That's all I need to say about the French elections. I've already said too much about saying they're Russian. But there you go. That's.
You're one step ahead of me.
Yeah. I apologise. But yeah, the French elections. Macron and WikiLeaks, wasn't it, released some of his documents again?
No, it wasn't WikiLeaks. It was just a dump on Pastebin, I think.
Oh,
hacked material. It was like 9.6 GB of French political intrigue there.
Right, okay.
Macron guy.
Yeah, who's, you know, been in with the banker cartel for years.
Now, one thing here, Dave, I would say on the French question is... They may say the Russians are trying to influence the result, right? But you never hear anyone saying that the Russians were responsible for the candidates that were put up.
Yeah.
And you have to admire a system which can produce for the public, for this exercise in popular democracy, two candidates that none of the public really want to vote for. So you get your choice of literally a fascist or... this kind of neocon, neoliberal Rothschild, literally a Rothschild banker guy. So the Russians might try and influence the result, which one of these horrible people wins. But the French political system itself produces those candidates. And, you know, there were these kind of the Vulcan guy, the Varoufakis guy from Greece.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, he was busy trying to tell leftists they had a duty to go out and vote for an extremely right-wing Macron in order to save France from the even more terrifying spectre of fascist rule. Why should people on the left go out there and vote for someone you know, whose policies are completely designed to crush them. It's completely nonsensical. When was the last time we saw an election in a major Western democracy where the choice was a communist and an extreme left-wing candidate? And do you imagine that the British Legion or all the right-wing types would all be saying, oh, we've got to turn out and vote for that, you know, super left-wing guy. We've got to keep the communist out. You know, it just never happens, does it? But they're getting the left over a barrel in our Western democracies at the moment because they're continually playing this game. You know, you get you can have the really, really scary one or the not quite as scary one, but you can't have the one that you actually would like. No, that's not on the menu. So this it seems to me this is the game that's being played. And if left-wing people go out and vote for that right-wing guy, I mean, you're literally falling into the trap for next time, surely.
Well, interestingly, on Julie's show just before ours, when she had loads of people phoning in, it seemed that a majority of the feedback that she was getting from her listeners were in, you know, all up for, like, Theresa May, which...
Oh, dear.
Yeah, yeah, which to me is really confusing, right? How people... So, in France, where a huge majority had swung over to this... The Macron guy, he's bought and paid for by the banking cartels, as we've said. You know, I like the way they keep making a really big deal out of his wife, who's 25, his senior.
The Guardian kind of loves that, doesn't it? It's like gives them a chance to dig out the identity politics.
Well, someone has said
this kind of highbrow way.
Well, what's interesting is someone had said that's not his wife; that's his CIA handler. He met her when he was 15 at school. So that's when they started
grooming kids.
Yeah.
Since he was at school.
Well, this is the thing. That is actually what happened, from all accounts. She met him at 15. She's 25 years his senior. Hence, when this guy turned around, tongue in cheek, said CIA handler. There is some possible string of a thread of.
Well, it shows how things can change. When he took that job at Rothschild, he was basically told by one of the people there, the person said to him straight up, this kills your political ambitions. 10 years later, president of France.
Yeah.
So it shows how the thing can turn. But as I've said, we're in this situation, and to go back to Hillary Clinton and Trump, of course, this was the game that Hillary Clinton's campaign played. For any of our listeners not familiar with this, this was one of the deep parts of the story, which was that the WikiLeaks and the DC leaks revealed that Hillary Clinton's team of advisors and strategists, they're so smart, literally compared to the rest of us, they're so smart that they came up with the idea that the best way to win is to actually choose the Republican candidate that we are most likely to defeat. So that was part of their strategy. Actually, they're not that smart because Lenin said the same thing almost 100 years ago. Lenin said the best way to control the opposition is to lead it. And so Hillary Clinton's team were taking a leaf out of that book. And so they basically deliberately tried to get Trump nominated because they had calculated that because he was the most extreme of the candidates and the least experienced, he would be... you know, the softest one to face. So, of course, it just backfired horrendously.
Yeah, in a massive
way. The Clinton team have never taken any responsibility
for
that approach. They're still in denial about it. And they actually took two measures that were catastrophic. The first one was helping Trump get selected. So they actively worked to get him chosen as the Republican nomination. The second one was they ignored all of the internal evidence that Bernie Sanders would score better at the polls than Hillary Clinton. So one, they chose the outrageous candidate to face off with, and then they ignored the fact that their own candidate was a dud compared to Bernie Sanders because they needed to, you know, have the coronation for Hillary. So, yeah, they also played a similar game in the US, but it horrendously, horrendously backfired.
Yeah, and it seemed to... they got what they want in France by the looks of it, it seems, at the moment.
Well, they stepped back from the brink. I suppose, actually, if you think about it, for people, it will... there's a kind of smug satisfaction you can have, can't you, when your centrist guy, I've got no idea really if there's any such thing, his policies are all very right wing. So again, they often call Tony Blair a centrist. Just seems to be one of these labels that doesn't mean anything. Or it means something like incredibly pro-business and right-wing, but doesn't want to admit it. That's what it means. But I suppose there's a kind of smug satisfaction for a certain section of the French public that, you know, we saw off fascism's threat. You know, they can take heart from that. But it would be much better if fascist candidates were simply nowhere near the levers of power. It would be better for everyone. Marine Le Pen and her gang will be back again. I think Paul Nuttall must be crying into his cornflakes when he sees that she got 11 million votes and he can barely wrestle up 11 in the UK. And in his heart, Paul Nuttall just cannot understand why. What is this moral failing of British people of not being able to just be simply as racist as French people and German people? We're letting the side down. Why can he not just put his finger on, you know, the button?
We'd just like to say cheerio to all
and
the
again,
French and German
Paul,
listeners.
Paul Nuttall is another. Oh, sorry, Paul Nuttall is another one, Dave. Where there's no there. This racism that he believes is inside every heart of every true-blooded, you know, red-blooded Englishman. It's not there, but he's convinced that it is because he thinks everyone in the world is basically like everyone in Britain is like Tommy Robinson, but ashamed to admit it in public because all of the politically correct people since the 1980s have made it difficult to be a public racist these days. Right. That's his logic.
Right. We have 5 minutes,
poor
Jay.
That's all.
Yeah. We have 5 minutes left, Jay, and we've run out of time for.
Well, we can't deal with that Facebook one that we had. That was going to... Sadly, that was my kind of... predicting the future thing that I trailed at the start
right, well,
of the show.
We can,
right at the
we,
end,
we, can roll
we didn't
that,
manage to cover it.
We can roll that over next week. I mean, because that
we will,
is... will,
but it just shows, doesn't it, that I can't even... You know, I can make my own predictions on my own radio show with you, and I can't even manage to fulfil them.
Well, to be honest, we should have done that one first, actually.
It's why I'm not a betting man.
I did. I used to. And I don't now for obvious reasons. No, well, actually, when I did it, I was living in my parents' pub years ago when I was a kid, and we had a banding machine. And I used to go up to my dad as a 14-year-old and say, Dad, can I nick a pound and stick it in there? And he'd give us a quid. And I'd throw it in there and I would win. And I'd give him back the pound, and then, you know, over a period of 3 weeks, I took enough money out of this machine to buy myself a new stereo. And then one day, I goes back down into the pub to put another pound in. By this point, I had obviously money to put in it. I put a pound in, and I stuck about £3 in. Didn't get anything out of it. My old man turned around to me and he said, you having difficulty there, Dave, getting any money out of that machine? And I said, yeah, what have you done to it? And he changed the running order of it. They work on cycles, don't they? And he said to me, let that be a lesson to you, son. You've managed to, you've gambled, you've earned some money, you've bought a stereo, you've walked away with a bit of money, coin in your pocket. Now let that be a lesson to you. And actually, I've not gambled since then.
Well, I'd like to give Paul Nuttall £1 million and say to him, you can have this £1 million, Paul, but you must place a bet. You must use the whole million to place a bet on yourself to be elected MP.
He wouldn't surely do that.
You
no.
bastard.
Yeah. Who would I?
I'll say you can keep 30p for your bus fare home, Paul, but the rest has got to go to Mr. Ladbrokes.
Yeah. Well, do what the DWP
does. Oh, well,
on
the same subject, though, you know, Paul Nuttall can't get the free money anymore, but Simon Dantzuk is he's twisting like a fish on a hook over his speedy exit from Parliament. So this week he resigned and set off, you know, let off a broadside against Jeremy Corbyn as he did so. Today he's announced that he's going to stand in Rochdale as an independent. And he's already put in some really low blows against this Mr. Lloyd guy, Tony Lloyd, who is the who Labour have nominated. Have you seen his comment about Tony Lloyd?
No, what's that then?
He said, Tony Lloyd is 68 years old. He said... He perhaps sees Parliament where as a retirement home and is intent on pottering around the Palace of Westminster. So, you know, what a horrible kind of opening shot from Danksuk. And I did tweet back to him. I said, it's preferable that an MP views Parliament as a retirement home rather than viewing it like yourself as a knocking shop.
Yeah. Well, interestingly,
just horrible Danksuk again.
Jeppy's just shown me a BBC article that's saying that he's now he's denying some new rape allegations that have come up.
Oh, yeah, that's true as well, isn't it? The Rochdale, I've got this Rochdale story here. Do you know this website? It's called Rochdale Online.
Yes.
And they've got 10 reasons why Danksuk shouldn't be an MP. And then actually they've got like another one, just a bunch of bullets that are 10 more reasons. But brilliant.
It's like 20 reasons.
Here's one. This is my one from earlier. Had sex with another woman young enough to be his daughter on his ex-wife's sofa whilst his two young boys slept in the next room, having consumed two bottles of wine. Had sex in his constituency office with a 22-year-old. Continues to sell his sleaze to the highest tabloid bidder, despite claiming to be worried what his young sons will read about him. And it's been revealed this week that he's being investigated following another rape allegation. So the son has that one. It's just terrible, isn't it? It's just terrible. Hopefully it won't go very far and he'll have to. He'll either get crushed at the election or he'll just have to back out.
He's gone. He's fired.
Sacked. Gone.
He's gone.
Goodbye.
I just mean that the election here is an independent. You've got to hope that he gets crushed.
Right, yeah, well, I can't
on
see
that
him.
Note.
Yeah, yeah. Happy days are here again. Okay, well, on that bombshell, we shall call the show a show and call it quits. Thank you very much, Jay.
Oh, thanks, Dave. It's been wonderful.
We will definitely roll over this Facebook stuff, actually, for next week, because we had some Facebook stuff on the show last week about, you know, the way they're sort of hunting down teenagers to be able to sell their information to various companies. And this is an extension of that, but in a sort of election special sort of sense. So we'll cover that next week. But thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you, Jay, again. And enjoy your week, everyone, and we'll speak to you, I trust, shortly.